It's my privilege to introduce a speaker for tonight. When I left Ridgeview in December, about 400 and some odd days ago, I haven't had a drink in 498 days, but I didn't really learn how to live sober until I got out and started going to AA meetings. And the first day that I was in an AA meeting, I told them that I was a newcomer, and a gentleman came up and said, "Some of us are going to go get something to eat, and do you want to go?" And I thought, well, maybe I should go. And I guess that started a friendship where I listened to people talk about living sober, and so I thought, well, golly, you know, maybe that would be something y'all would want to hear tonight. So I'm going to introduce Carl. He's my sponsor from Athens.
I am Carl Monk, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Carl.
I am sober tonight through the grace of God and the fellowship of this program. I say that for my benefit and not for yours, because I never want to forget the night of December the 8th, 1975. I was lying in my bed drunk and had been drunk for months. And at that point in my life, I could not go 4 hours awake without drinking. Otherwise, I would start shaking like a leaf on a tree. I just simply could not. My wife had, of 17 years or 18 years, had told me not to come home unless you can stop drinking. And I could not stop drinking, so I had gotten an apartment. She and my teenage boys was living in one part of town, and I was living somewhere else. Society had taken my driver's license away from me, and I had just previously, 3 days before, had been picked up driving with revoked license. And I had been riding around thinking about, well, I had been going to bed at night, closing my eyes and thinking, wouldn't it be nice if I could just go to sleep and die? And I had also been riding around, had planned a way of suicide. And I never tried it, because if I had tried it, I wouldn't be here, because it would be foolproof. But that was the state I was in. But I was lying there in the bed that night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was drunk. And there was a moment of clarity. For some reason, it was just absolutely as clear as you guys. I could see for the first time, and I had been to some AA meetings. I had gone to some AA meetings for my first wife. Staying sober for her, was not working the program, could admit that I had a problem with drinking, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was. My problem was that I drank too much. If I could quit at the 14th or the 15th or the 18th beer, I would be okay. The thought of never not drinking just never crossed my mind. You're crazy if I thought I was going to go without drinking. But it was just, you know, I just could not see where alcohol was really the problem. I could see I drank too much, but I never really wanted to quit. I just wanted the problems to go away. And I was lying there, and it became absolutely clear to my mind that I was going to die drunk. I could see that as absolutely clear. And it's the first time, I think it was at that moment, I think I took the first step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then the next thought that went through my mind was that no one else can do this for me. And if I want to get sober, if I want sobriety, I've got to get involved in my own recovery. No one else can do it for me, because I realized if my first wife could quit drinking for me, I wouldn't be drunk. She just wouldn't drink and I'd be sober. But it didn't work that way. And then the next thought that went through my mind was that God was the answer. Now, I'm not a religious person, have not been. I'm more religious now than I was at that point. But at that point, you have to keep in mind that I grew up in a Bible Belt of North Carolina, and most of the churches around there was this hellfire and damnation, hard-shell primitive Baptist. And everything I have ever done and thought I wanted to do and wanted to do, I was going to be zapped and consigned to hell. It was just nothing I could do that would be worth doing or that would be pleasing to God. So what I had done all my life was, after I got away from home, I just left, never went to church, to hell with God. And I've damned it many, many times. And if anyone who needed to go to the church, if you want to do that, if you need a crutch, something wrong with you. I just thought the people in the church was a bunch of hypocrites. So here I was lying there and realized that God is the answer. And I at this point, I had never uttered a prayer, honest prayer in my entire life. But that night, in the depths of despair, and that's where I was, absolutely the depths of despair, I simply said, God, I can't quit drinking. I want off this merry-go-round. Would you please help? I went to sleep. I woke up the next day, and it's been over 26 years ago, and I haven't had a drink since, and I haven't shaken like a leaf on a tree. I don't understand it. I know it happened. And I have quit trying to understand it. I just accept it as a gift, and since it's a gift, I want to treat it as a gift and enjoy it and get on with it. So that's basically what got me here. Now let's go back and catch you up a little bit on just where I came from. I'm a farm boy. I grew up on a tobacco farm in the Piedmont of North Carolina. You know where Durham and Greensboro are, about halfway between that. Same county that Chapel Hill is in. So I grew up on a farm. My parents basically have an elementary school education. My dad could barely read. My mother read well, but my dad could barely read. They encouraged me to go to school. I'm one of seven kids. Five of us are alcoholic. Two of us know it, and two of us are sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My older sister lives in Winston-Salem, and she has about 23, 24 years of sobriety. The others basically have died drinking and never having a clue that they had a problem with alcohol. So far as I know, my dad did not have a drinking problem. He had a lot of isms, but I'm not sure that alcoholism was one of them. He was just a man that was emotionally not equipped to live in this world emotionally. And the family that I grew up in was one in which love was not shown by action or words. I never ever remember my dad and my mom standing and hugging each other. And showing any of that kind of affection. And I don't remember them hugging me and telling me that they loved me. I was supposed to know that I was loved because I was fed, I had a place to sleep, I had a job to do, and things, that type of thing, but it was not a verbal type of thing. So that's sort of background that I came from. Most of the people I knew around there drank, and my parents did not object to drinking. Or smoking. I started smoking when I was 12 in front of them. I realized early on that I did not want to be a farmer. And I enjoyed school. And I was encouraged to go to school. So God gave me a good brain. And I went to school. And when I got out of high school, I had the opportunity to go to college. I went to college and worked my way through junior college in Western North Carolina, Morris Hill. Left there and went to Duke, finished up my undergraduate there, went to Rutgers and spent 3.5 years, got a master's and a PhD there. I had my PhD when I was 25 years old. Not that I was that smart. It was during that time of the Korean War, and if you were smart, you could stay out on a student deferment or go to Korea. So I chose the former and stayed in school and got my doctorate. Ended up, my first job was, I was a Florida Gator. I went to the University of Florida and taught at Gainesville for 5.5 years. Took a job with Georgia and was down at the bomb plant with the Ecology Institute of University of Georgia, full-time research for 3 full years. And then in September of 1968, I joined the teaching faculty on campus at Athens. And retired there in 1990, after 30-some years in academics. So that's basically where I've been in terms of academics. I used to, my drinking started, who knows when one really started. My first drink and my first drunk, I was 8 years old. I know that. And it was as clear today as if it happened yesterday. I can remember it was on a Saturday in July. And a brother and I walked over to There was a black gentleman who lived on the farm. He had a little six-year-old son who was my closest playmate. One Saturday morning, we walked over to his house, and he had a barrel of homebrew that was ready to drink. And he took a glass and poured him a glass, and he gave his son and me and my brother a glass, and I drank it. And then my brother and this gentleman walked on over to the country store, which was about a mile away, and I stayed back, was running around the yard playing with my friend, and I began to feel good. And I'll give you one guess of what I did next. I went back to the barrel and got some more homebrew. I don't know whether I had a third, fourth, or fifth glass. I know I had two glasses. And at that point in my life, I went into a blackout. I remember nothing else the rest of that day. You know, it took me until I was 43 years old to realize that's alcoholic drinking. The first time I drank, I liked it. I couldn't get enough, and I had a blackout. Now, that doesn't mean that when I was 9 years old, I was a knee-walking drunk. It just wasn't the case. I don't know when I had my second drunk. I was never reprimanded for getting drunk. It was, you know, you did it, kid did it, slip it off. Next day it was just ignored and I went on. But I can remember whenever I had a chance to drink some, I drank some. I remember drumming when I was a young teenager, stealing a bottle of wine from an uncle and drank that, and I got deathly ill on it. And as a consequence, wine was my last drink of choice. When I was into really the drinking, I would drink wine only if I couldn't get something else. But anything that was sweet made me sick, and I upchoked. So I just stayed away from it. But I drank some of it anyway. And when I was in high school, I would get occasionally drunk. I'd go to dance on Saturday night. I was one of these persons who was so self-conscious that I couldn't get on the floor and dance, because as I'd walk in a room like this, and you all be talking, and I think everybody in the room knew I walked in the room. I don't know why I thought I was so damned important that 100 people would recognize that I walked in the room and would be aware of that. But when you're that self-conscious, you have built yourself into a place where it's hard to live. What I did was to build myself a house, a glass house. I put myself in it, and I gave everybody the right to look in, to see me, know what I was doing, know what I was thinking, and know what I was planning to do. You didn't know you had that power over me, but that I gave you that power. And because I gave you that power, then I felt always like I was under a damn microscope. So I could go to the dance and I couldn't dance. I'd see the people out there dancing and I would envy them. But I found out one night I could go out to the back, get somebody to get some moonshine, turn it up and take a couple of swigs, and I'd come back in. I didn't give a damn what you thought. I could get out there and I joined the human race. That's what I did. I joined the human race. And I think that's what booze did for me. It enabled me to be the person I could not be without it, because without it, I became something in a straitjacket. I was always wondering what the heck you were thinking. Started drinking, I didn't care what you thought. That was until the next day I woke up and I began to have this remorse, and what the hell did I do last night? But anyway, that was that. But I would drink occasion during high school, and when I went to college, I didn't drink much. I was not one of those kids that went to school, took the money, because my parents didn't send me money. They didn't have the money. The money that I made went to eat, went to the education. I did not buy the booze. I don't know why. I just didn't. But by the time I got out of, and I drank a little in college. I just didn't have the money, but I did drink a little. When I got to graduate school, I remember keeping me a little bottle of vodka, and I would be late. I would be the last one to leave the building at night. I would stay there and study till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. But whenever I left, I would take me a glass of water, pour me a little bit of vodka in it, fill it up with water, and I would sit there and study and sip. And I wasn't drinking that much, but it was a constant companion. And I think occasionally I would go off the deep end and drink too much. I can remember going to a chemistry class one morning, and the professor gave me back an exam that I'd taken 2 days before in a damn blackout, and I don't even remember taking the exam. I passed it, and I didn't learn anything. You know what I did? I almost broke my arm, patted my head, damn, I'm smart. Hell, I can do that. Damn, I'm drunk. I'm great. I did not learn anything about what it did to me. I was so blown up as to how grand and great I was. I got a good mind, but sometimes when it comes to, as the big book says, when it comes to alcohol, I got blind spots. I can't see what the alcohol is doing. But anyway, I drank a little in college, got out and went to Florida, and then I got money now. I've got money and I can drink. But basically, I didn't drink during the day. I'd get off of work, stop at the bar on the way home, have a couple of beers, go home, and if I wanted some more beer, I'd go back to the bar and drink a little bit. I was only 25, 26 years old. Hell, you could drink half a dozen to six, 12 beers a night and get up the next morning and never know it. I'm fine. I wasn't having a problem. Then that's when I moved to South Carolina, started working at the bomb plant. That's the way I drank there. But I would get drunk on the weekend, go on the golf course, drink a case of beer, get drunk Saturday night, Sunday taper off, Monday be ready to go back to work. And thought I was doing fine. My wife began to fuss at me. Then I come to Athens and get to Athens, and about a month, year after, I joined the Moose Club. Athens was dry then. You had to belong to a club before you could find any booze unless you wanted to get it from a bootlegger. So I joined the Moose Club, and I was at the Moose Club 4 o'clock every afternoon. I was the first or the second customer there every day when they opened. And that should have told me something if I knew what to look for, but I wasn't looking for it. And then I started going at lunch. Instead of going eating on campus, I would go to Allen's. I don't know if any of you have ever gone to campus or know Normal Town. There's a little bar there called Allen's. You can go in there and get a pitcher of beer. I used to go there and get a hamburger and a glass of beer, back to work at 4 o'clock, go to the Moose Club. It wasn't very long that it turned out that it was Allen's. It was a pitcher of beer and a pitcher of beer and a pitcher of beer in the Moose Club. I just didn't go back to work. And by this time in my life, it was where I was waking up in the morning, I was beginning to have shakes and the hangovers. And you can't, and I'm lecturing now, and you can't go to class and stand in front of people and lecture and shake like this. You just flat can't do it. I'm not going to do it. So what did I do? I started going by and getting some beer in the morning. I could drink two beers on the way to work, and when I get to work, hold my hands out, and I'm steady. I can go in and lecture drunk, but I'm steady. And if you've done this long enough, you can lecture without, you don't need notes. It's all up here, and if you're not too damn drunk, you can sort of pull it off. And I did. And I did. I'm not... if I had to punch a clock at 8 o'clock in the morning and be answerable at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd have been fired years ago. I'm not happy with what I did, but a full professor at the University of Georgia is a license to steal. Who cares what you drink as long as you're bringing money in and you're teaching and showing up? At the height of my drinking, if you'd have looked at my curricula vitae and only at the curricula vitae, you would have seen a person who was publishing 3 to 4 papers every year in refereed journals. You had grants from the federal government to the tune of a couple $100,000 a year. You had postdocs in the lab working for me, 4 or 5 PhD students working for me, teaching, and all that. If you looked at that, you'd say, this kid is great and he's going somewhere. But I was on a skid and I was going to hell in a handbasket and couldn't see it. That's what was happening. And as long as I was bringing money in and writing papers, who cared how much you drank? That's basically what. I never had anyone say, why don't you come to work and not smell like a brewery? You know, if you're doing your work, that's fine. I'm not fussing at them. That's just the way it was. So that's basically, at that point, as my wife had been fussing at me, she had talked to me into going to a halfway house. I went to a halfway house in Athens. For 10 days to 2 weeks, I agreed to go to the old Georgia GMHI back in June of 1975. That's where I went to my first AA meeting. Stayed there for 2 weeks. I had no clue why I was there. I was wondering why in the world a person of my character would be locked up in there with guards walking around at night, keeping us from escaping. It just went right over my head to what my problem was. But that's where I went to my first AA meeting, and I got out and I went to AA. I went to AA for 3 months. I didn't drink, read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, left it on the bedside stand so my wife could see that I was reading. Now I'm back in bed with her, and that's what I wanted to be. And she made me mad, and I got drunk at her. Started drinking Listerine. That was my first, when I started back. If you want to get drunk, you don't have to go to a beer store, liquor store, go down to a drug store. You can buy all you need to get there. I guarantee you, it'll get you going. What that happened was that it ended up with 4 months of the most miserable period of my entire life, from September of 1975 to December 1975, was hell. And that was where I ended up in bed that night with that condition that I described earlier. So That night when I made that prayer, it took me about 9 months in this program to realize that night I took, in essence, took steps 1, 2, and 3. When I realized I'm going to die this way and there's nothing I can do, was basically step one. When I realized that nobody else can do this for me, that was step two. And when I realized that God was an answer and I needed to ask for some help, that basically was step three. It took me about 9 months for me to become clear enough to realize that I had done, in essence, part of steps 1, 2, and 3 at that moment. And that was all I needed to get into this program. When I was in the program early, I did not have a sponsor. I had asked a person to be my sponsor, and he did me a favor by saying no. I asked him for one reason, the only reason I asked him, he was a full professor on the University of Georgia campus. And hell, I was a full professor. I need somebody who's smart and know what this program is about. And that's the only reason I asked him. He knew how to stay sober, but he knew I asked him for the wrong reason. I ended up later asking an old boy who was a technician on campus who saved my life. Boy who had an awful lot of experience in this fellowship. I've had four sponsors since I've been sober, and one of them was a technician on campus, one of them was a retired farmer, and another one was a dairy farmer. And those guys have taught me you don't need college educations in this program. All you need is to have a desire to not drink, and the fellowship of this program, and that's what I need. I need people who are founded in this program, and how much they know and what their degrees are, or they're out there a dime a dozen. I wouldn't give you a penny for any one of them. That's just not where it is. I was told early on that this disease, alcoholism, is not a disease of the intellect. It's a disease of my soul, and that I needed someone to help me to learn how to live that way. But anyway, that night I realized I took step 1, 2, and 3. But you know, it took me, and when I first got into the program, I heard a lot of people talking about if you're having trouble with a step, you probably haven't done the step before that. So I started to think about step 4. And I'd get to step 4, and I'd run into a darn wall. I just could not get into it. So since I'd had this problem with God, I thought, well, maybe I need to go back and do that. So what I did early on is in February of 76. And this is what I did. I'm not recommending it. This is my story, and I'm telling it, and I'll tell you what I did. I'm not recommending it. I made a decision in February of 1976 to reread the Bible. And I said, I'm going to start with Genesis 1. I got rid of the King James Version. I didn't want the these and the thous and wherewithals and all those. I got me one that plain English. And I made a commitment. I said, I'm going to start with Genesis 1, and I'm going to read 3 chapters every day, at least, and until I finish Revelations. And it from February, and it took me until August. I don't think it was a night that I went by that I didn't read at least 3 chapters. Some nights I'd read 20, 30 of them. But I read it. And, I don't know whether that helped me or not. What I was doing is that I didn't have a God that I could cuddle up to. I began to realize the God that I understood was the God I thought my parents or the adults understood. I didn't have one. And I had just internalized what I thought they had. And I just couldn't cuddle up to this God that was going to zap me one day and consign me to hell. I ran from that. So I read that, and in September of that year, I realized one day something came to mind, and the parable of the prodigal son is what came up. And I had always associated myself with the kid that stayed home and took care of the animals and did all this, because that's what I always did. I always tried to earn my love, earn every damn thing. I'd do what you told me to do. I'm going to have to earn this thing. But I realized that I was a prodigal. I was the one who had taken this life and had wasted it by drinking, and had gone and absolutely thrown it away, self-will run riot. I had gone as far as I could go on my own. And when that night when I asked for help in a drunken state after damning God for years, the first time I had asked for help, I got it immediately. And what went on in this head was that I am not in this world to do good things so God will love me. God loves Carl Monk regardless of what I do. I'm convinced if I went out there tonight and got drunk it would not destroy the love that God has for me. He may not like what I did, but the love between him and me does not depend on what the hell I am doing. And that enabled me to begin to get rid of this vengeful God and begin to find one that had some love to it. And then that's when I could begin to make some move. So I don't know that my going back through steps 1, 2, and 3 was totally wasted. In my case, it helped me to get rid of a deity that I thought was some there that wasn't there, and I have one now that is more personal. So it helped me in that respect. But every time I would get to the fourth step, I would back up and go through step 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, get to 4. But what it turned out, the problem wasn't the fourth step. The problem was the fifth step, where once I finished the fourth step, I was going to have to tell you what I had done. Now, let me back up. When I was, and it all started basically back when I was about 10 to 12 years old. When I was between about 10 to 12, I approached my dad and I had a homosexual affair with him. That's basically where it started. And it lasted for about a 2-year period. And something went on in me at that time that basically built a wall around, and I wasn't about to let you in. You'd go to school and the kids thought, well, my dad and I went fishing this weekend. Well, I wasn't going to tell you what the hell me and my dad did that weekend, because I was old enough and heard you guys, kids on the playground, talk about queers and all this. And I don't know of anyone who wants to be rejected, but that's exactly what was in my mind. If you knew what I had done, you would absolutely laugh at me, run me out of town, I would be totally rejected. So what I did was just walled it in and just never talked about it. It was never discussed. And people all my life have patted me on the back and said, Carl, you're a nice guy and doing good things. And I would smile and say, thank you. This head would say, but if you only knew what I've done, you wouldn't say that. And from that time until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I constantly put myself down. If you only knew me, you wouldn't say that. If you only knew me, you wouldn't say that. I know today that what I was trying to do was to earn my dad's love. And I don't know why I thought that, because I'm the one who approached him. I don't know. I just can't get back to that. But I do know that's what I was trying to do, because I had a brother that was a couple of years older than I who had almost died. And I don't remember this because it was at a point where I don't remember, but there was a bonding between my dad and him, because during the time this boy was going through some sickness, the dad and he got close together. And you could tell, you could sense there was a bond between Colin and my dad that wasn't between me and my dad. And I wanted that closeness. And I think that's what I was trying to do. And it didn't work. It just didn't work. But nevertheless, I can't blame him. And I don't even blame myself anymore. But what this did is it took me until I was in graduate school. When I was at Rutgers, I was about 23 years old. So it was about a 10-year period there in which I absolutely did not talk to anyone about any of this. And I just got to the point where I could not stand it. So what I did is that I found a psychiatrist, and I figured, well, if I go to a psychiatrist and talk to them, it's a safe person, he's not going to go out and tell everybody. And I'm not going to see him every day on the street. So what I did is I went in and talked to him for an hour. He charged me $50, and $50 for me in 1958 was a bunch of money. And the man never said a darn thing. He sat there for the whole hour and wrote and wrote and wrote. And when it got through, he wondered when I was coming back. And you know what this head thought? I got out and said, why in the hell am I paying him $50? All I did was talk. He didn't say a damn thing. I don't know what I expected to get out of him. What I was going to do is I was going to go tell him this, wave a wand, and everything would be all right. I don't know what I thought. But I didn't go back. But what it did, it relieved the pressure of holding this in, because I had told somebody. I had gotten it out a little bit. So I didn't talk to anyone else. I got out of graduate school, went to Florida, was down there for a couple of years, began to get to the point where I had to talk some more. I was drinking more, but I needed to talk. So I found a Methodist minister. That's a safe person. So I talked to him three or four times. And he said, Carl, you're not a homosexual. He says, there's a lot of kids at that age. Those things happen. Most of them outgrew it, and you just haven't. But you know what goes into this? Hell, if you've done it once, that's what you is forever. You know, if you've ever messed up one time, you screwed up forever. And that's what most of counselors in my entire life have told me. Said, you know, just because you've done something like that for a period of time doesn't mean that's the way it is going to be forever. But anyway, he tried his best to help me, and he did, because I didn't have to talk to anyone else for a period of time. It relieved the pressure. I go to Aiken and work for South Carolina, work for 3 years, get to Athens, and I have to go talk to someone else. What's happening is that now the time I've got to talk getting closer and closer and closer together. I'm drinking more and more and more. And I have no idea. I used to say I have some idea of what a woman feels if she's been raped. I don't really know that. But I do know what one feels like when one feels like everyone knows that you have had a homosexual affair and you feel like you've got it branded right up there, queer. You know, that's what I felt like, because I could not get it out of my head. Wherever I went, it was always going on. It was always up here in his head. But I couldn't sit down and talk to people, except occasionally when it got to the point where I had to sit down and relieve the pressure, and I'd go and find some safe person, but I wouldn't take their advice. I'd just simply get rid of a little pressure, and then I'd be out doing the same thing. I wasn't treating the problem. So I get into AA, and this is what was holding me down from doing the full step. If I go through this, I got to sit down and talk to somebody. And I had this sponsor, and God bless him, he was a wonderful guy. I had kids, and he said, don't come talk to me about kids, because since I've been married 5 times to 4 different women, so obviously I don't know anything about marriage, I don't talk about marriage, I don't have any kids, I don't know anything about kids. And since he hadn't had a homosexual affair, he didn't have anything about that. So I had to go. What I did is that I went outside of AA. I found a counselor there in Athens who had a small group, and I agreed to go with that. And I went there for a full year. I went there for 1 hour and 15 minutes every week. And the rules were that you go in, shut the door, and we just sat there until somebody wanted to talk. And during that year, I talked a lot and I cried a lot. And I went through this whole thing, And you know, one day the counselor jumped up and said, I just want to beat you in the damn head. I said, what's wrong? He says, a 10-year-old boy does not have emotional control over a 50-year-old man. I never thought of it, you know. But, you know, at the end of that year of talking, one day I began to feel good. Something began to happen on the inside, and I began to realize I was having some serenity. And I was riding to a meeting one night, and I had this saw another moment of clarity. I had this sort of thought in my head that went something like this: if I could live my life over again, what would I do different? And then the next thought was, you aren't going to have any foresight. And then I realized, if I live my life over again, I'd do the same thing. I would do exactly the same thing the next time I went through my life. Then the little caveat that came into mind was, then why in the hell, if you can honestly say you were doing the best you could with what you had, why in the hell do you always feel so damn guilty about these things? And that's when God graced Carl Monk again, and I turned a whole back of guilt loose, and it just clunked, it just went off. And I don't carry guilt around anymore. I just don't wear guilt anymore. It doesn't fit me well. I don't like it. I've had my belly of it. There are times when I will get down and I will reach out to get it, but I begin to, it's like a hot stone. I turn it loose. So I am absolutely convinced that if I went through my life again, everything that's ever happened up to this point, I'd go right back through it again. And I began to realize one day that I was happy. And that's what I always wanted. That's what I really drank. I wanted to be happy, but I didn't know how to get it. You know, I was trying to get happy. I'm going to get happy if this happens. I'm going to get happy if I publish those 10 papers I published this year or whatever. And happiness had come to me when I went through the fourth and fifth steps and cleaned the garbage out on the inside. And today, so far as I'm aware, there's absolutely nothing in here that I'm hiding. My life is an open book. I am happy to share it with anyone whenever it needs to be shared. I used to think I would be embarrassed standing up in front of people saying that I had that affair with my dad. It no longer embarrasses me. It just something happens, and I would be an idiot if I allowed that to ruin my life 40, 50 years after it happened. And that's what I was doing. I was holding it in, and I just simply wasn't man enough to deal with it by myself. I had to drink myself to get into this program and put the 12 steps of this fellowship together, and it enabled me to put the life together that I've always wanted. And happiness today is just being able to be me. I have never been as free in my life to be Carl Monk. I can remember back in my drinking days, you would not have seen me wearing any bright colors. I always wore muted colors. I didn't want to be seen. I wanted to just blend in. And I find that my favorite color today is bright red. I love red. And it isn't because I am trying to be a show-off. I just damn like red. So I wear red whenever I have a chance. See there? And it is freeing that I can be me and not be what I think you want me to be. Because that's what I had always been all my life. I had always tried to do what I thought you wanted me to be, and it got me into trouble. So then I got through that fifth step, and then I went on into the sixth step, and I began to realize, to me, the sixth step is for my emotional problems, my character defects, what step one is for my drinking. We can't do it all together. I got to stop drinking before I can find out what character problems I've got. And if I go through steps 4 and 5, I can find out I've got a lot of things, and I begin to realize I can't stop being selfish by myself. What I have to do is use the steps 6 and 7 and go through that, and maybe if I work with God, perhaps God can, in his time, help me to work on those and get rid of them. But that's, to me, is basically what step 6 is all about, is looking at it and realizing I can't do this, just like I couldn't quit drinking by myself. I can't handle my character defects by myself. But I can with God's help if I will ask and willing to work on it. I hear a lot of people talking about, I've resorted to old character. I was told if you're doing old character, it's current character. And we're doing is fooling ourselves when we talk about, I fall back to old character traits. Because if I'm doing it today, it's current character traits. So after working then with steps 6 and 7, I got into the men's steps, and I had some problems with that because I read in the book Alcoholics Anonymous where we're like tornadoes and we go through life wrecking havoc wherever we go. And I've listened to people who talk about and write, and I've got this list as long as from here to Athens. I started making my list, and it wasn't a big list. And I began wondering, what the hell's going on? And then it finally dawned on me one day, says, Carl, you're not in this program trying to get your list as long as someone else. Your list is your list, and their list is their list. And get out of this business of comparing. To my knowledge, I have made amends and am making amends currently to all those people that I know and am aware that I had some that I harmed, and the ones that I did the most damage are the ones that are closest to me. I have two 40-some-year-old sons in Athens. For the last 15 to 18 years, we have met every Saturday. We just do it on a regular basis because when they were growing up, I was not there. I was one of those guys that grew up. The wife is supposed to stay home, barefooted, pregnant, take care of the kids, and do all that, I guess. Because that's just, and I was supposed to go out and make the money. And when they needed to go to play soccer, your mom's got to take the soccer. I'm too important. I got to go to work. But instead of going to work, I went to the Moose Club and drank. So while they were out playing soccer and doing things like that, I wasn't there. And as a consequence, my oldest son, when he graduated from high school, and he graduated about the year I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was an angry young man. And he left the house and never asked me for a penny. Went out in the world on his own, and he was living in Athens, but I didn't see much of him. My younger son has always asked for attention, and he and I used to get together and have breakfast. And one day, he told me that, that the brother had said that he felt like he had drifted away from the family and would like to have a little closer ties. I said, "That's the best news I've heard in a long time." I got him on the phone and I said, "Let's start having lunch together." And he was working at a job where he could only have about a half an hour, and Saturday noon was the time we did that. So we started meeting at the Huddle House and just having a sandwich and just getting to know each other. And the youngest son wasn't going to give up a free meal, so he showed up one day. And we've been doing this for 15 years. And my current wife has two daughters. If they're in town, we get together. And my ex-wife's parents used to live here in town. He passed away a few years ago from Alzheimer's. I'd go pick them up, so it'd be grandmom, me, and my boys. Sometimes it'd be 3 to 10 people there. And we've got to know each other a great deal. And it's something I miss. If I'm in Athens, I will let them know. And I'll have a luncheon engagement tomorrow at 12 o'clock. So far as I'm concerned, this is an amends to those boys for me not being there during their informative years of growing up. But I did find out, I used to think, well, do I have to make an amends to this guy that I got into a fight down in the Moose Club? I was down there one night, he was drunk, I was drunk. He made some comment about my friend, and I bopped him upside the head, and we out on the floor scuffling. And no, I don't know the man of men. We were both drunks, and we were doing what drunks do. I had to take, that's when one goes off. I don't need to make amends there. But I have made amends to those I think I need to. If I find someone that I have harmed and haven't made amends, I am perfectly willing to do that. I know I had a very difficult time with my in-laws. I sat down and many times tried to write a letter to them, and I was started saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." I said, "It wasn't, I'm sorry." And I just couldn't do the amends. And I was eating one day, and I turned around, and they lived in New Jersey. And they would come through into Florida. They'd go to Florida every November and stay there, and in April they'd go back. And I hadn't seen them in Coon's age. Their daughter and I had been divorced and I had remarried, and I turned around and lo and behold, there they were. So they invited me to sit down. And I was able to, that day, at that time, make an amends. And what I wanted to say is that, it wasn't that I'm sorry that I drank your daughter up. What I wanted to say was that I love you and I miss being with you and I would like to see more of you. And they said, "That's fine. That's what we want to do. We understand that you've remarried and we would like to meet your new wife." They met that wife. She was sober for 16 years in this program, died of ovarian cancer, but did not have to take a drink over it. And I have since remarried, and they have taken my third wife and welcomed her. So, I had to make amends to those because that was one of the neatest couples. Never once in my marriage did they ever say, "You ought not do that." They stayed completely out of it. And they're one of my favorite couples. And I just needed to be able to sit down and tell them that I loved them and not say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," because the sorry wasn't what I was trying to say. It was meant deeper than that. The 10th step, I don't do the 10th step on a daily basis, but there's something constantly going on in my head. I doubt if AA thoughts and AA steps are out of my brain very often. And I'm more aware of what I'm doing, and I'm getting better about righting wrongs that I did yesterday. I have a hard time, if I did something right now, it's hard for me to turn right around and make an amend. I've got to think about it a little bit and hurt a little bit. But I have found out it's worth my time doing that. Because I have found out that if I am beginning to have problems in this fellowship, if I will make myself sit down and do an inventory, somewhere in that inventory process, I can begin to find where I am getting off the spiritual path and I am beginning to do things which are beginning to be unhealthy for me. And I tell you, I just don't like being miserable anymore. So I try to stay close to the program. The 11th step is the one that I spend, I think, a lot of time on, and it's partly because I have no clue most of the time I have since joined the church. I am a deacon in the church. I am very active in, I am as active in the church now as I was, but I am in AA. I go to 6 to 10 meetings a week, but I'm also that active in the church. If I had to give up one of them, I'd give up the church, because this is where I learn to live, and this is where I go for people that know who I am. I have shared everything that I've shared here tonight at church, the people that know who I am, because I just don't work well when I am acting and being something that I'm not. So if I'm going to be around some people, I want them to know who I am and where I came from up front. When I do that, then I can be me. I don't have any hidden agendas. I'm spending an awful lot of time trying to understand what my faith is. I don't have any real problem with Christianity, but there are a lot of things in that I have a hard time just being able to reach out and take, yeah, I believe that, because I'm not sure that I believe that. So I've spent a lot of time reading. Reading is a sheer joy. I read. And I spend a lot of time in that, not in AA, but I think it's doing the same thing that 11th step is telling me. I'm looking for a relationship with the God of my understanding. And I have spent a lot of time on the 12th step, putting this thing to work in my life and trying to pass the message on to other alcoholics and getting involved and putting back into this program a little bit of what I've taken out. I could work the rest of my life, and I could never put back into this fellowship what you guys and gals have given me in sobriety. I just couldn't do it. And one of the things I include in my prayer most of the time is that in my nightly prayers that I ask God, please don't let me walk out of this fellowship and try to stay sober without going to meetings. I've got dozens of friends there in Athens, some of the people I've sponsored, some people I've known who were sober before I got here. We haven't had a drink in 15 to 50 years. I haven't seen them in an AA meeting in 4 or 5 years. I don't want to do that. I do not want to do that. I want to die the day, I want to go to a meeting the day I die. You know, I don't want to die tonight, but I'm not afraid of dying. I don't spend any time on that. But I do want to stay active in this fellowship. I have been very involved in service. I've held every trusted servant job I know of. I've served as a DCM for the 16B district. I'll sponsor a lot of guys. I don't spend much time with them. I give them my phone number, and I basically tell them, I'm where the phone is. You phone me. I don't phone you. And I rarely ever, if I phone one, it's a matter of asking for a ride. It's not for anything else. I don't check up on them. If they want to get drunk, that's their business. I just don't run them down, because I know that for me, I can't make someone else get into this program. And if a person wants to go 2 weeks and not come to the program, that's fine. If you want to go get drunk, that's fine. Just don't call me and expect me to come and join you. I'm willing to share what I know about sobriety and how I put this program to work with anyone who wants to do that. But I'm not willing to run anyone down. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has been very good to me, and that's all I need to say. Thank you.
George Mize, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Carl for coming tonight. I've been looking forward to this night for a long time, and I think y'all will remember this. I just got to tell you, though, I was at a meeting last week, and I try to take off on Wednesdays and go back to Athens to the meeting that my home group. And there were a bunch of people there from a local treatment center and they were talking about the things that we all talk about, and Carl just sat there and didn't say anything for a long time, and then he said, "Well, you know, AA is not for candy asses." And I just thought that was pretty neat.